Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And I am so glad that you're here with me now or whenever you're listening to this program. Thank you so much for caring. And what I like to do is bring a little light, a little joy, a little just a moment of good breathing. Breathing is so important. And little things to help you through your day. You know, life can be so frustrating, so challenging every day, depending on what station you're listening to and what news you're reading or not reading. Things can be so overwhelming. It's not the friendliest place, planet Earth, but I like to focus on the friendly things, the happy things, the things that can keep us going and make us do better things for the planet, to make it a better place for ourselves, our family, and for the future, because I think the future matters, and I want to be a part of making things better, even when I'm long gone. Okay? So, with that in mind, the theme of this show today is hope, and we're going to be talking about things that give us hope. And I have no one better with me here in the studio than Robin Camille, who is the executive producer of the PBS television show Urban Animals, and she's a passionate animal rights activist who has written several award-winning public service announcements for PETA, which ran on Fox, ABC, and Bounce television affiliates nationwide, and she co-wrote the song Free the Monkeys with fellow activist and HLN television host Jane Velez Mitchell, which shed light on the mistreatment of monkeys being used in lab experiments in Hendry County, Florida, as well as the song Free Lolita, Let the Girl Go, to raise awareness about the orca Lolita, who is being held captive at the Miami Seaquarium. Her children's books Saving Benjamin and Food for Alex were recently published, and each of those books encourage social responsibility and community involvement, and that's what we're going to be talking about right now here on It's All About Food. Robin, it's so good to see you.
Yes, Karen, how are you?
I'm fantastic.
Good to see you too.
Yes. So, I love children's books.
Yes.
And I don't know. Well, I suppose some people realize this, but children's books have a profound influence mm-hmm. on children.
Yes.
And there are new studies. I've been talking about them a lot. How our brain, based on its foundation, doesn't want to accept new information sometimes when it's contrary to what we grew up with. Mm-hmm. So when people hear about how a healthy plant-based diet can really change their life and bring health to them and save the planet, and it happens to be the nicest thing you can do when it comes mm-hmm. to eating, there are parts in our foundation that we were brought up with that says, no, no, no. And the brain will make up excuses, actually, to support what it learned originally. So we need to have tools for children to have them open their mind to all kinds of things. And I think that's what you're doing with your two books.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to do, because I share those sentiments. I understand. Because it's too late to start preaching to people at 35. You have to get to them early for yeah. the reasons that you just mentioned. I have been involved with the movement to free Lolita, the orca who's being held at the Miami Seaquarium. That fight has been going on for over 20 years, and she's still in that tank because you have human beings who, as you just mentioned, have a mindset that is set. And no matter how much you try to appeal to them to see the plight of this orca or to be compassionate, they're not getting it. And it's out of that frustration. And I've also worked with PETA. I've done demonstrations with PETA where I've gotten into, you know, very heated exchanges with people. Although the children, they were the ones who were more receptive to the message. And then I had an aha moment, and I said, well, you know something? Maybe I should shift this, because I was becoming frustrated, as many of us do. And I said, I can't give up the fight. I just have to change focus, as a good general would. You know, you have when you're in battle, you have to change your strategy. Mm-hmm. So that's why I opted to write the children's books to get the message to the children, because I think it's important for us to get these messages to the children early, to encourage them to have a healthy relationship with our planet, to respect our planet, the oceans, the animals, to be compassionate. Because sometimes even if you try to relay these messages to teenagers, it may be too late.
Yeah.
So that's why both of my books are geared toward young children ages 3 to 8. Yeah. So as soon as you're out of diapers, honey, Miss Robin's got a message for you. Okay. Yes.
Well, I'm thinking of children's books. Okay. When I was young, it was Dick and Jane and yes. Dog Spot. Yes. But there were plenty of them where if I went back to read them today, there would probably be images that I would find horrifying. Mm-hmm. Like maybe, and I can't think of a book specifically, but I'm sure I read books about going to the zoo.
Right.
And what a lovely thing it would be for the family to go to the zoo.
Right.
To watch the imprisoned non-human animals who are living in an environment that's so unnatural, and mm-hmm. they're miserable and lonely, and
yes.
it's horrible.
Yes.
But it's normal.
Yes. And, you know, your parents were just, you know, providing you with a book that they thought was fun. And it's just a lack of knowledge. And that's why it's important to get the knowledge out there, to get the word out there. Because what I have found is that I can talk to someone until I'm blue in the face. And I know you've done the same. But if you pass that knowledge on to a child, that child can be that light in that household. That child can compel their parents to start thinking a different way. Quicker than you or I would be able to. And that's the importance, because if you educate a child, you can change the world.
You know, I'm catching up on recent movies, mm-hmm. and I just watched Captain Fantastic. Mm. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I haven't seen that.
Okay, it's fantastic.
Okay, Captain Fantastic is fantastic.
Yeah,
there's
one thing I don't like about it, but it's about a man who's raising his 6 children mm-hmm. on a property that he owns in the woods, mm-hmm. and they're living pretty naturally. Now, they do hunt, and that was the only downside.
Right.
But he was teaching them a lot of morality and ethics that were really good. And then when they had to come back to the real world because mm-hmm. his wife, unfortunately, had died and he had to deal with the family, mm-hmm. There was a fascinating conversation with the sister's family mm-hmm. and what was normal to them. And you just see the things that with respect to food and so many other things that are accepted as normal that are really outrageously crazy
yes.
that these kids learned from such a young age. And it goes both ways, from those who were raised one way and another way. Mm. We have so much impact molding young children
yes.
and their minds.
Yes.
But I do recommend it. It's a fun film.
Wow. I will certainly see that. Yes. Yeah, because children are like little sponges. And they mimic everything that they see. It's amazing. Because I've been around children and I've done some things. I mannerisms and they'll pick right up on it. It's amazing. And that's why we have to be very careful what we say and do around them. And we have to make sure that we get healthy things in those little brains. Good things, good thoughts,
yes,
energy.
I was remembering why I brought up that movie. I had remembered and then I lost my train of thought and I just found it.
Yes.
So before I lose it again, we have factory farming of animals, mm-hmm. which is a horrible thing. And many children's books talk about, well, they won't even touch it. I mean, they don't talk about animal slaughter or anything, although there might be a Thanksgiving table with mm-hmm. the turkey on the plate. On the big platter, and that seems really normal. But parents don't want to tell their children the truth mm-hmm. about where their food comes from, because a children's book about factory farming can be very frightening. And mm-hmm. there actually are a few that are wonderful. The author's name is escaping me, and mm-hmm. I apologize for that. But your books mm-hmm. kind of go beyond that, because mm-hmm. they're so simple.
Mm-hmm.
The story is so simple.
Yes.
And a child can find the obvious truth mm-hmm. in the story
yes.
without even having to know about trawlers and all the horrible things that go on in fishing today.
Exactly, exactly. Because with Saving Benjamin, and that's the goal, you don't want to frighten children. And I know some parents, of course, a parent's job is to protect their child, and you don't want any horrific images to frighten that child or scar that child. So you do have to relay the message in a way that engages the child, but not that doesn't frighten the child. And with Saving Benjamin, it's a book about two little girls, Tiffany and Taisha, who love playing with their little fish friend, Benjamin. But his mom won't let him out to play with them when they go to the beach because the shoreline is so polluted with plastic debris and garbage. And over 1 million seabirds and fish die each year from plastic debris and garbage because they mistake it for food and they ingest it, so they get sick and die. And I didn't put that in the book. I just said that, you know, that they do ingest it and they get sick. And I didn't, you know, I didn't get too morbid. But these young ladies, they get others in the community to help them keep the beach clean, clean their local ocean. And so Benjamin comes to get to play with them. So it's a good message. It's a fun message. Not morbid. You know, I did tell, you know, relay that, you know, ingesting plastics for the marine life is very dangerous. But the message got across and children actually love it. I was actually at the National Animal Rights Day last week, giving away free copies of the book. And the children loved it because what I'm doing now with Saving Benjamin, I have some fundraising campaigns. I have a You Caring campaign, a crowdfunding campaign. We're giving away free copies of the book because I want to get this message across because, you know, I do want to get it in schools down the line. But sometimes dealing with the red tape and the bureaucracy, it can take years and years and years. So what I'm doing is raising money to buy the books and get the books printed so I can just get these books in the hands of children. I have several summer reading programs that are waiting to receive books. Book Harvest in North Carolina is on the list to receive books. So we're asking folks just to donate to the campaign, which you can do by going to youcaring.com/saveouroceans. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I remember as a kid, there was a campaign, there were commercials, it was in the schools, and it was all about littering.
Yes.
And how we shouldn't litter.
Yes.
I got that message.
Don't be a litter bug. That's right.
But somehow, generations later, that message got lost.
Yes.
And now
yes.
The world is our toilet. The world is our garbage can.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And you can go to a beach, and, you know, I don't want to judge, but...
But go ahead, girl. Testify. It's all right. Testify, honey. I didn't bring my tambourine today, but go ahead, Karen. It's all right, honey.
A lot of people leave their garbage.
Yes.
They just leave it.
Yes. Yes.
And who taught them that? Who taught them that was okay?
Let me tell you something. And promoting the book and giving copies of the book out, you don't know how many people I know who live by near beaches and the shoreline tell me, they say, oh, it's not us. It's the people that visit the beach and just leave the junk. You don't know how many times I've heard that. And what I like to tell people is that this planet, think of it as one big apartment, okay? And we're all roommates here. We're all roommates here, okay? So if you leave a pile of junk in the living room and you go off to the bedroom, that pile of junk is still in your home. Okay?
Yeah.
That's the way to look at it. And so you leaving garbage and junk at someone at a beach that where you don't happen to live near doesn't mean you escape the drama. Because we're all in this together.
Yep.
We're all in this together.
And the sea life get it.
Yes, of course they do. Of course they
and
do.
And not just from garbage on the beach, unfortunately.
No,
I mean, all these things that you're talking about that poor little Benjamin has access to on his beach, that comes from so many places.
Oh, so many places. Illegal dumping, you know, oh my goodness, it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And the other thing, too, is that President Trump is proposing some major cuts to the EPA's budget.
I don't like to say his name.
I know, girl.
Show.
You know what, girl? I know, but you know what? It is what it is. But you know what? We can never rely on the government, whoever's in office, to do everything. It is we have to pick up the slack and we have to be the foot soldiers. We have to be the warriors to make our communities, our beaches, our planet safer at the end of the day.
That's the only thing that good that has come out of the current administration.
Yes.
Is that more people are waking up and realizing we have to participate.
Yes, yes. And I think that was a good thing because for far too long, people were happy with the status quo. As long as it didn't, there was nothing that was bothering them or intruding in their little bubble, they were fine.
Yes.
They didn't care what was going on overseas. They didn't care what was going on down the street or in other neighborhoods where people were suffering. But as long as they were safe and happy and they could, you know, do what they wanted to do and live their lives, they were happy. So I'm very glad because there's a lot of engagement. There's more activism. People are more aware and they realize they can't sit their buns on the couch. They have to get out and fight. So that is a good thing. So I'm happy about that.
Now, you have another book, too.
Yes, I do. Food for Alex.
I didn't read that one.
No,
I
you
only
didn't
read
that.
Saving Benjamin.
Yes, only Saving Benjamin, because Food for Alex is actually going to be out in September.
Okay.
Yes, that's going to be out in September, and that's a story about a boy, Jacob, and his dog, who his friend they actually play with all the time, and then one day he doesn't show up to play. They go to find him at his house and find out that his father has lost his job, and there's no food in the house, and that's why he hasn't come out to play because he's not been able to eat. He's not feeling well. So they actually mobilize the community to organize a food drive to get food to take to Alex's family. So, yes, that's another story.
It's a good story.
Yes.
And it's really important for children to hear these stories.
Yes.
We want to tell the children the truth.
Yes.
Because when they know the truth, for one, the truth is empowering and they don't have to make up stories in their mind as to why things are happening. I recently had John Joseph on this show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know John Joseph, but he had a really harrowing youth as a foster child.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And the stories in his book are just terrible. Mm-hmm. And he lived very close to the neighborhood I was growing up in. So I was thinking, wow, I had this happy little childhood and he was going through hell. But then I started to think about some of the children that were in my class from time to time that I thought were a little odd for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. And now I'm thinking, you know, maybe they were hungry. Maybe they were foster children that weren't cared for. Maybe they were just so poor.
Yes.
And you know, I can see that. I remember those kids, and I know.
Looking back.
Looking back.
Yes.
And if I had a book or a story that helped me understand that, I might have been able to have helped them.
Right, right. Well, the other thing, too, is that children often see the truth quicker than adults can. Or quicker than adults think they do.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, too, with hunger in America, it's growing. It's growing. There's millions and millions of children that go to bed every night hungry. But the other thing, too, Karen, and this is something that we need to change, and certainly we need to enlist the government to do this, people actually criminalize poverty. Because if a child is hungry and they're in school, and they mention to a teacher or a principal, I'm hungry, that teacher or that principal is encouraged or actually obligated to call the child welfare department because this parent is a bad parent. She's not or he's not feeding their children. And then there's a case opened and they may take the child out of the home. So, you know, parents and children are afraid to even ask for help because if your child is hungry, people jump to the conclusion, oh, you're a bad parent. No, they're not looking at the fact that this woman, this man, these parents are working two and three jobs and still cannot put food on the table.
Yep.
So they are afraid to ask for help, and we need to get that off the table, so we can have people willing and able to come to ask for help, because now they're fearful mm-hmm. of asking for help.
I've read stories in some schools where the child is shamed for not having the money to pay for lunch.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've heard stories. There was a story on the news last year about a paraprofessional who actually gave money to a child who couldn't afford a school lunch, and the principal fired her. And there was a big uproar about it, and I don't know whether she got her job back, but I mean, how can you let a child go hungry?
Mm-mm.
And she took the money out of her pocket. She didn't take it out of petty cash from the school
sure.
or anything. And they fired her. So it's, you know, I don't know, you know, I know you've got rules and regulations, but where's the common sense?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the common sense?
I know teachers that have brought in healthy food to
yes.
their class, snacks and fruits
yes.
all the time for anybody who wanted them.
Yes.
For two reasons. One was to encourage kids and have them ask about, you know, why do you do this? And mm-hmm. that opened the dialogue about healthy food. But some kids are just plain hungry.
Yes. Yes. Some kids are plain hungry.
And teachers have to pay for a lot of things out of pocket.
Yes, they do. I know teachers that have bought winter coats. Okay. The teachers, let me tell you something. The teachers here are amazing. They go above and beyond. They go above and beyond. I'm telling you, I've seen them do it. They go above and beyond for these children.
Mm.
They do.
Okay, now you sent me a video of Saving Benjamin.
Yes, that was a book trailer.
Yeah,
yes.
Who did that? And
well,
made
actually,
those great graphics.
Yes. Well, I have a team that works with me. The illustrator is Angel Matowski, who did all the illustrations. She's amazing. I had another team put together the book trailer. So yeah, I have an amazing group of people working with me. You know, I wrote the story, but I'm not an illustrator, so I had to enlist some other foot soldiers in this journey. So I'm very excited about that, and very excited about what we all did together and produced together. I'm very happy about the project, and hopefully it will serve as a message to parents, to children, and others who work with children to encourage them to save our oceans.
Now, in the other book, which mm-hmm. I haven't read your food book, is there any hint to vegan food?
Well, actually, let me tell you something. The story, the food that they bring to and collect to and give to Alex is actually a can of spaghetti. That's what's mentioned in the book, because actually it's based sort of a little bit of my life is in that book as well, because one time I was walking to school with my mom, and we didn't have anything to eat, and we weren't sure how we were going to eat that night, and I found a dollar on the street, and my mother said, "Oh my God, that's God." And she took the dollar and bought a can of ravioli, which mm-hmm. I love to eat. But you know, ravioli has meat in
yeah.
it, so I don't do that anymore. So that's why in the story I had Alex receiving cans of spaghetti.
Sure.
No meat spaghetti. Yeah, so that was you know, because I was trying to think of a nice, you know, vegetarian vegan option in a can. So he got spaghetti. Yes. 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 Yes.
Oh, that's
yes.
good.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I might
yes.
have given him Campbell's vegetarian beans.
Yes, yes, because he gets boxes and boxes of food, but the one single can that they hand
yeah.
him out, because basically what happens is Jacob and Pete, the dog, when they first find out he's hungry, before they organize the food drive, they run back to their house and just grab this can of spaghetti and give it to him.
Yeah.
Yes,
nice.
Yes, yes.
You know,
yes.
In mentioning those vegetarian beans,
mm-hmm.
I used to have them all the time as a kid, and I never
uh-huh.
never connected what vegetarian even meant
right.
on that can of beans.
Right.
It was just, you know, one of the cans
beans.
My mom bought, and, you know, we ate them.
Yes, that's right. It was just beans, honey, and they tasted real good. Yes, yes,
yeah.
And lots of fiber, healthy,
yeah,
you know.
They had a little sugar in them, too.
Yeah,
I think.
A little bit, you know, honey, it's sugar and everything. Oh, my goodness, tell me. That's another topic for another day.
Yeah.
Yes,
wow.
Yes.
Okay, so what else can we talk about here with Saving Benjamin?
Well, you know something.
Books?
Listen, you know, I went to the first annual World Ocean Festival on Sunday as well.
Where was that?
Oh, that was actually on Governor's Island.
Mm.
And, you know, it was very enlightening and very encouraging to see so many people involved because, you know, with the waterfront, the other thing with waterfronts, you know, you have developers that are so eager to build buildings there and destroy property. And, you know, of course, anytime you have a building, that there's going to be more pollution and blah, blah, blah. And people were discussing trying to save and salvage New York's waterfront and the waterfronts throughout the country instead of having them just be condo developments. Mm-hmm. And that's another major, major thing. Yes, I mean, you can enjoy the beach by visiting the beach, and you don't necessarily have to have a condo development if you want to live near the beach, you know. but all of this overdevelopment, it is definitely contributing to the ocean's pollution as well. So that was an issue and a topic that I was glad to see someone brought up, because here in New York City, honey, there's a condo everywhere. It's just so much building, and of course the waterfront the developers see that as prime territory. So. And they don't really care about the fish or the aftermath of the building and all of that. They don't care about that.
No.
Yeah. So
don't.
I was glad to hear that discussed there. I was very glad to hear that discussed. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's good. I love using the word vegan and sharing the vegan message. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I know that there's this knee-jerk reaction from a lot of people who won't positively respond when you say you have a vegan message.
Right.
And so your book, Saving Benjamin, for example, is a global message for everyone just to respect the environment and be aware of all the garbage that's going on.
Yes, yes, yes. Be aware of all the garbage. And as I said, you know, you dumping something or polluting a beach or dumping something in an ocean or a river or a lake and thinking that, it's not in my backyard, but it is in your backyard.
Yep.
It is in your backyard because, as I said, the earth is our home. We all share it, and it is in your backyard. And sooner or later, that garbage is going to travel to an ocean or a lake or a river near you.
Now, I hope nobody fishes for little Benjamin, because as we learned in the movie Finding Nemo, fish are your friends, not food.
That's right. That's right. So Tiffany and Taisha can play with Benjamin. Yeah. So they don't want him to be eaten end up on someone's dinner plate. No.
Well, I can't believe it. Yeah. We've ate up a whole half hour.
Oh, well,
We
always have fun. And thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, this summer, throughout the summer, I'm going to have the free book campaign for Saving Benjamin. So if there's anyone who works with children, any educators involved in summer programs for children, please reach out to me at pleasesaveouroceans@gmail.com. If you want to contribute to our crowdfunding campaign, you can visit youcaring.com/saveouroceans.
Is that YOU?
Yes,
the letter
YOUKRING.com/saveouroceans.com. I mean, excuse me, I'm sorry, I messed that up. Oh my goodness. It's YOUKARING, YOUKARING.com/saveouroceans. Woo!
Yeah, those C's and K's.
Yes, those C's and K's, girl. Woo! Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks for joining me, and it's all about food.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
For looking so sunshiny and sparkly.
Well, thank you. Honey, when in doubt, wear sequins. What can I tell you?
Okay, we're going to take a very quick break, and we're going to be back in a moment with Carl Pope to talk about Climate of Hope. everybody. I'm back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you so much for joining me. And we're continuing on the theme of hope and giving you inspiration. And I am very fortunate to bring on my next guest, Carl Pope, who is the co-author of a new book, a New York Times bestseller, Climate of Hope. He currently serves as the principal advisor at Inside Straight Strategies, looking for the underlying economics that link sustainability and economic development. Former executive director and chairman of the Sierra Club, he has served on the boards of the California League of Conservation Voters, Public Voice, and National Clean Air Coalition, among many others. He is the author of three books, and he writes regularly for Bloomberg View and Huffington Post. Carl, thank you for joining me today.
It's terrific to be with you, Karen.
Yes, so these are very interesting times. And
indeed.
And,
indeed.
Yeah, and you've written about a very hot topic, and I'm sure people have abused that pun quite a bit, but climate change is trending quite a bit right now, and that's good for your book, I imagine.
Well, it's unfortunate because the reason climate change is trending is because the current occupant of the White House is casting himself in almost a James Bond movie as a global villain by pulling the United States out of the Paris Global Accord that was going to move us forward to a more prosperous and a more sustainable world.
Thank you for not mentioning his name.
I only make puns on his name. I might do that during this program.
Okay, no problem. I just don't like to say it. Okay, so every day we read the news and there's something horrible that we discover, and it's very difficult to stay focused and stay inspired and continue with our activism, whatever activism we are involved with. My particular focus is food. And so this book, thank you, was full of a lot of inspiration, and it's really good to hear positive stories about things that are moving us forward. So I appreciate that.
Well, the thing that was very exciting about writing the book Climate of Hope with Mike Bloomberg was we started out with the notion that we were sure that if you broke the climate problem down into its individual pieces, we would find solutions and they would be affordable. What we never dreamed was they would all turn out to be profitable. We're now in a situation where instead of saying to people, you know, you ought to pay a little bit more for electricity now because 10 or 15 years from now, there'll be fewer risks from a destabilized climate. But now we're saying to people, would you like to lower your utility bill? And I have yet to meet anybody who says no. So it's like, well, great, go clean, because clean is now cheap. That's the new reality. We've crossed a very important marker in human history when the new things that are cleaner and better for us are also cheaper.
Clean is now cheap. That needs to be a bumper sticker. Now, unfortunately, the people in power and some of the billionaires, aside from Mike Bloomberg, want to stay with what's current and what isn't really affordable.
If clean is cheap, then the people who sell it to you don't make as much money.
Well, why are the Koch brothers still...
The people who are making money selling you dirty, they want to keep selling you dirty. The Koch brothers want to keep selling you dirty.
Yeah. Well, don't they know that they're not going to make as much money as if they started promoting sustainable energy?
Well, no, actually, the Koch brothers will make less money because the Koch brothers have a monopoly position. And if you have a monopoly and you open it up to new, better ideas, you don't make the same kind of profits. The Russians are going to make, let's be clear, the fact that gasoline is cheaper because more people are driving more efficient cars is good for drivers. It's good for the American economy. It's good for the air. It's not good for the Russians. Not good for the Saudis. So there are losers in a transition from a wasteful, dirty economy to an efficient, clean one. but most of us are winners. That's the important thing to understand is you and your friends and your neighbors are going to be winners. Vladimir Putin, not so much.
Okay, I want to talk mostly about food, but before we get into food, I just wanted to talk very briefly about your Beyond Coal program when you were with the Sierra Club and how successful you were at partnering with businesses to reduce the amount of coal that we're using.
Well, we started out with the premise that there had to be, we couldn't commit ourselves to another 50 years of relying on a dirty rock that was killing tens of thousands of Americans as the primary source for electricity. And there were, when we started out, already evidence that wind and solar could actually provide affordable electricity. In the last 5 years since that program began, and I'm no longer actively involved in it, but I'm still very proud of it, the price of wind and solar has fallen so far that they are now generating the cheapest electricity the world has ever known. It's so cheap that the coal mining museum in eastern Kentucky changed their electricity supply from coal to solar because it saved so much money that they could keep their doors open.
Yeah, I loved reading
wind
that.
Wind and solar are so cheap that there are a huge number of coal-fired power plants still operating in this country, which if you shut them down tomorrow, you could pay the utility that owns them all the profits they make and buy brand new contracts to generate wind or solar energy, and your utility bill would fall. So we are about to have the cheapest electricity the world has ever known, and it's also going to be the cleanest electricity the world has ever known.
Okay, now this message is not getting everywhere because I just read that in Australia, the Carmichael coal mine was just green-lighted to create this the biggest coal monstrosity the world has ever seen.
And that coal monstrosity has nobody to buy its coal.
So why are they doing it? It's crazy.
Because the government of Australia is paying them to do it. This is this is a purely subsidized project. This is a project which makes no economic sense. There's been a lot of analysis showing it. And even with the subsidies, the people who build it are probably going to lose money. But that doesn't stop people. Once you've spent $500 million on a mistake, it's awfully easy to spend another $1 billion of somebody else's money on that mistake. And that's what we're doing all over the world. We're spending other people's money on yesterday's mistakes.
Okay, well, back to some of the good news. So some of the things that I enjoyed, now you co-wrote this book with Mike Bloomberg, and I live in New York City, and it was fun to read about some of the things that I had experienced over the last decade when he was our mayor.
Like beach chairs on Broadway.
Yes, I loved when that happened, and I love that area now that's all open and we don't have cars going through Times Square. That's fantastic. Now, the City Bikes is a great program, but I have to admit, I have yet to get on one. I am petrified to ride a bike in the city streets. I'm not doing it. It's scary enough for me. I don't own a car, and it's scary enough for me to cross the street with the drivers we have. But it's a great program.
New York drivers are much nicer than they used to be, just for the record, because I'm not a New Yorker, so I can compare. But I actually used to be quite terrified walking in New York, and I now enjoy it.
Well, come to Queens, where I live. It's scary. All right. Now, my favorite subject is food. And you have a chapter called How We Eat. And the first thing you said that was that this was the most difficult chapter to write about. And I wanted to know why changing diets gives you a headache.
Changing my diet doesn't give me a headache. Asking other people to change their diets gives me a headache because I've concluded that we actually, eating is something you learn from your parents, and once you've learned it, it's very hard to learn anything different. I mean, it's not accidental that we have restaurants all over North America that advertise that they sell comfort food. It's not accidental that people talk about my grandmother made the only good apple pie that I've ever eaten. It's not accidental that people from certain parts of the world can't eat a vegetable unless it has a chili pepper in it.
Mm-hmm.
We are brought up and we are imprinted with a certain diet. And even if it turns out later on that that diet is not the best for us or not the best for the world, it's very hard to get people to change. And so you start out with the reality, and it's a simple reality. If the world first ate less corn-fed beef, and remember, corn-fed beef is a cow that's been given something that makes it sick as its diet.
Mm-hmm.
That's the definition of corn-fed beef. So if the world first ate less corn-fed beef, second, ate only sustainable seafood, and third, ate less meat overall, and fourth, grew crops using natural ingredients rather than artificial chemicals. If we did those things, we would all live much longer, and we would solve a solid third of the climate problem.
That's
just
right.
By doing that one set of things. And we would definitely be better off, but we wouldn't necessarily be eating what our parents made for us, and it's very hard to get people to do that. And so I don't like to lecture people about what they eat. I do like to remind people that actually it's not all meat that's the big problem. It's corn-fed beef. That's the big problem. Most seafood is great, but not farmed shrimp. There are three or four things we can do that still enable you to eat pretty much what you like to eat, but to do so in a much healthier and more sustainable way. But then you get into the fact that, well, the most ecologically expensive food is the food no one ever eats, because there's no benefit. And in many developing economies, a third of what's grown in the fields rots before it gets anywhere. And in many overdeveloped economies, like the United States, a third of what gets to your refrigerator never gets eaten, gets
mm-hmm.
thrown away. So very simple things, like I was just asked by People Magazine to give them some possible tips for things you can do at home that are more sustainable. And I said, well, go to a restaurant that gives you smaller portions. Because once the restaurant gives you a big portion, you will eat more than you need or more than is good for you, and then you'll have to throw the rest away or they will throw the rest away. So very simple things like getting, you know, plates didn't used to be 14 inches wide. People used to eat on 8-inch plates, and they were actually quite healthy people. They were not little tiny midgets. They were quite healthy. They were eating on 8-inch plates. Now you buy a 14-inch plate. You buy a 14-inch plate, you will get fat. That's an absolute iron rule.
I agree to that. With that, for the most part, but I'm a vegan and I eat a lot of plants, and so I eat giant salads, and they need big plates to have all that fiber.
I hadn't thought about that. That's a good point.
Yeah.
You need a big salad bowl. I'll agree.
Yeah,
I eat a big
and it's
salad
frustrating
bowl,
actually.
But you don't need a big plate for your steak because you'll eat too much.
Right, exactly. But when you go to a restaurant and you just order the vegetable and they give you like two stalks of broccoli, and that's, you know, I want a pound of broccoli. So,
okay.
You know, when we're
good
talking
point.
About just
Very
vegetables and fiber, we
Very
need big plates. And that's fun. You know, I agree with you. We don't get great results when we lecture about eating. But I do talk a lot about food and what I love about food. And I love making healthy, environmentally friendly food delicious and fun. And the fun thing about eating vegetables is you can eat a lot of them all day long. Now, I want to ask you, so I understand how difficult it is to change a culture in terms of their tradition and foods, and I agree that we shouldn't be doing that, but we've already done it. So we've taken this god-awful standard American diet of lots of animal foods and junk foods and processed foods and lots of sugar, and we have exported it, and India and China are eating it up. Literally, and as a result, not only do they have more chronic diseases, but we are now extrapolating what the demand for meat is going to be and the terrible impact that's going to have on the climate. So we have we have changed people's eating habits.
Well, but we do it by marketing, not by lecturing.
Bingo.
And, yes.
Marketing.
Yes, so
we
marketing
need more marketing.
Marketing.
For
well,
good
we
foods.
Need a different kind of marketing, for, and we also actually, you know, the change in the dietary pattern, I mean, certainly I don't, China's, I don't know China well, I know India moderately well. If we didn't subsidize with about, to globally, the subsidies to grow more corn than the world can possibly eat mm-hmm. are about $200 billion a year. Now, for comparison, the amount of money that we're arguing about when we talk about how we're going to finance the whole transition away from dirty energy to clean energy is $100 billion a year. And we spend $200 billion a year subsidizing the production of corn. Well, nobody can eat that corn. And in fact, even all the cows in the world can't mm-hmm. eat that corn. So we have to turn most of it into corn syrup. And then once we have this corn syrup, it's basically free. So people are basically juicing up all kinds of products all over the world, in China, India, Mexico, the United States, with corn syrup. And if we didn't have agricultural subsidies, we would still have corn. But we would have corn that people wanted to eat, not corn that had to be turned into sugar.
Mm-hmm. And organic corn can be so delicious.
It can indeed. And corn is a perfectly, perfectly terrific food product. Corn syrup is the devil's bargain.
Is what?
The devil's bargain.
Mm.
You know, it's a very... the whole, if you look at the whole ecosystem that surrounds the production of excess corn, you know, you get global warming, you get the dead Gulf of Mexico, you get polluted drinking water supplies in the Midwest, you get lots of diabetes in Mexico. I mean, the list of bad things that results from the overproduction of corn is really staggeringly long.
You mentioned waste before, and I want to talk a little bit more of that because I don't think people really realize the impact of wasted food and where it comes from. I just got an email yesterday from a friend of mine who sent me this quote: "If food scraps were a nation, it would rank third behind U.S. and China as the largest source of polluting greenhouse gases." And
that's a figure I wish I'd had when we wrote the book. That would have been a great figure for Climate of Hope. I hadn't heard that figure.
Yes. Well, apparently this is from the New York Commissioner of Sanitation on WNYC. Anyway, and I haven't checked the numbers to see if that's exactly correct, but we waste a lot. And can you talk about all the places where food is wasted and how it causes greenhouse gases?
Well, to begin with, I can't talk about all the places because it's too complicated,
yes.
But I can give you some of the big ones. Food rots in the field when farmers in poor countries don't have the right equipment to harvest it. Food rots on its way from the fields to the wholesaler, particularly in warm, moist, tropical climates where people don't have simple bags to store it in. Food is thrown away in countries like the United States, Europe, and Japan, when we make a rule that says if a banana has a brown scratch on it, you can't sell it, even though that has absolutely no impact whatsoever on its flavor or nutritional qualities. And finally, food gets thrown away from your kitchen because the pull dates on fresh food that you buy in American grocery stores are deliberately presented in a way that will confuse you and cause you to throw the food away when it's still perfectly healthy for your family. And in the United States, we spend about 0.5% of our GDP on humanitarian foreign aid, and we spend 1.5% of our GDP throwing food away.
I was with some dumpster divers a few years ago, the people that go around and look through the garbage for food. And some of them don't call themselves dumpster divers. They call themselves food what do they call themselves? They call themselves freegans, but what's behind it is they're freeing or liberating the food that's been thrown
away.
And, you know, I went out a few times with them, and it was stunning in New York City to see packaged fresh food, clean, perfect, in the garbage. And there's so much of it. We made a lunch, and I think it was CNN or 2020. Somebody did a show on it, but it was incredible the amount of food on a daily basis that we throw away just here in New York City. And it's true everywhere. We need a better system for that.
No, well, if you actually had somebody's done the study and tested it, and you just need to have a date on the package that says not purchased by. The date that's on a package of food you buy is a date that assumes it sits in your refrigerator for 2 weeks after you buy it.
Mm.
So what you think is what we call the pull date, that's not the date you're supposed to throw it away by.
There's some foods that'll last forever that have dates on them.
Those are mostly not terrible. Well, but the ones that have pull dates mostly are things that you do need to eat relatively promptly after buying them, but you don't need to eat them in 3 days. And the pull date is the date by which it's supposed to be purchased, because the assumption is you'll keep it for 2 weeks, but the average householder thinks they're supposed to throw it away when they hit that date. That's why there's all that fresh food in the dumpsters. Unopened packages, people looked at the date and said, oh, this is not good anymore. And that's actually not accidental.
Mm.
The system is based on encouraging waste.
Oh, it's another one of those economic things, I bet.
Yeah, there are a lot of economic things around, and they're mostly not for your benefit.
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of capitalism, because I find that when the goal is simply profit, people who have the advantage will exploit whatever they can. I know that Mike Bloomberg is a big believer in capitalism, and he's someone who actually, I believe, has a good heart and wants to do well. Not everyone is like that. Do you think we can get to a friendly, sustainable place in a capitalistic society, or is capitalism going to have to change a little bit and include some social or sustainable motives?
Well, I think that's probably above my pay grade as a question where we end up long term. But I can tell you this. I'm actually kind of a market fundamentalist. I really believe that markets are very powerful if they follow a few simple rules. And the first rule is, you ought to own what you sell. Otherwise, it's not a market, it's fencing. But in fact, about 15% of the world's climate problem, as we outline in the book, is the result of illegal logging. People going at gunpoint and taking timber they're not entitled to, and then selling it on the international market where they're allowed to sell it. And if we made everybody own what they sell, markets would work much better. The second thing is, you ought to pay for what you take. If I walk into a 7-Eleven and, you know, pick up a bottle of milk and walk out without paying for it, that's not a market. That's theft, shoplifting. And people who take things from common places, people who destroy forests or pollute waterways, are not paying for what they're taking.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you ought to choose what you buy. The idea that the government was going to tell you what to buy was what communism was all about. And theoretically, we're not in favor of communism, right? We're capitalists. But the answer is, you don't choose whether you get polluted water or dirty air or contaminated food or a disrupted climate. Those are not choices that you get to make when you go to the grocery store. Those are choices that other people make for you. And that's not what capitalism was supposed to be about, but too often, that's what capitalism really is about. So I'm in favor of, the first thing we should do is make capitalism live up to its own promises. Then we can see if it's the right system or not. But mm-hmm. right now, we're letting people get away with shoplifting, fencing stolen goods, and making you buy stuff you never chose and don't want. And, hey, I'm against that. and anybody who's a capitalist should be. Well, I noticed they're not all, but that's a different problem.
Okay. I'm glad you're against that. I'm against it, too. And I'm definitely for businesses that work towards making the planet better and helping save the planet, and as you outline in your book with Mike Bloomberg. So thank you for writing this book, Climate of Hope, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
I appreciate your taking the time to educate everybody about food, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Terrific.
Okay, take care. That was Carl Pope, everybody, the author, co-author of the New York Times bestseller Climate of Hope that he wrote with our former New York City mayor, Mike Bloomberg. And I definitely was inspired quite a bit by much of what was in the book. And I was encouraged. We have a lot of things to work on. We have to get rid of all that corruption that goes on because basically we do have a lot of good laws. It's just when they're broken that we have some problems. And when they're taken away, like our current administration is doing, taking away some of the regulations that keep things safe, that's problematic. But I like the idea that capitalism can actually promote doing what's right and how it can be economic. We talk about that on the show a lot when we talk about reducing meat consumption, where businesses are now jumping on creating plant-based meats and plant-based cheeses and plant-based milks. It's cheaper, and that's definitely one way to get it to the masses. Okay. Well, did you enjoy that? I did. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. I am Karen Hartglass. You know where to find me, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And I love to get your emails at info@realmeals.org. Please join me next week. We are going to have a fantastic program with David Young, who joined me in the studio recently from Hong Kong. He has a company called Green Monday, and I want you to hear all about it because it's very inspiring. That's next week. In the meantime, have a delicious week.